And naturally, as his time in the West went on and he began lecturing more and more, his English got better, better and better, of course. So that by the 20s, it was really quite excellent. And as you all know, he had a really impressive gift for putting things in such a way that the language is extremely memorable. All of those things that you see as sayings of Murshid, most of them are just sentences lifted out of his lectures. I mean, he was just standing there talking and he said these things. He didn't sit down and write them as aphorisms. He just spouted aphorisms as he was speaking, apparently.
So you're not talking about the Gayan when you say that.
No, the Gayan actually was made from notes in a notebook. And they were things that he wrote down when he would have interviews with Marids. When after they left, he would write something in the notebook that was inspired somehow by the encounter with that Marid. So those were in written form, most of them. But the aphorisms, for example, the collection known as aphorisms, those were all made by Kafayat Lloyd from his lecture. She just sat there and wrote things down as he was speaking. When In an Eastern Rose Garden was published, Murshid raised no objection to the lectures that were in there, but it gave him the idea that perhaps he could give lectures that were designed to be made into a book, because that's a very kind of collection. It doesn't have any particular theme that it carries through. His first attempt at doing that was in 1922. He didn't give any series of lectures at the summer school in 1922, but then he was invited by a man named Sirdar von Toil, Baron von Toil, who lived in The Hague, had a summer place out in the dunes at a place called Katwijk aan Zee, Katwijk on the Sea, which was a little beach resort, but also connected with the little town a little more inland called Katwijk, which is notorious in Holland for being one of the most religiously conservative places that there is. Still has its reputation. But Baron von Toil had this expansive summer house. It was just a summer house. It was, you know, it had no insulation or anything. You could only use it in the summertime. Beach house in the dunes there. It had a big studio with windows all around that could hold quite a few people. And so Baron von Toil invited Murshid to come there to Holland and give a second summer school after the one was finished in Surin. The summer school in Surin always ended on September 13th. The Hijrat day was always the last day of the summer school. And so then he went to Holland and he was there for 2 weeks and in this big studio overlooking the sea. Now this was the latter part of September, so there was no one there at this beach resort because school had started, the vacation time was over, so it was just completely abandoned place in those days. The hotels that they were way in the far end of the beach. Now they extend the whole beach, but in those days they were far away from the site of this summer house. And so Murshid gave this second summer school there. There was a gathering of about 40 people who came to be part of this, all of them Dutch with the exception of a few English people who came. Sophia Green came over, and also a man named Shabazz Mitchell, who was a newspaper reporter in Southampton and who knew shorthand and took down the lectures in shorthand as Murshid was speaking. He gave two lectures every day. In every afternoon, he gave a lecture on the problem of the day. That was one of his favorite titles to use, the problem of the day. But every evening, he gave a lecture on the inner life. The lecture on the inner life began just after sunset. The entire group would gather in this big studio with all the windows looking out over the dunes and the sea. And Murshid would come in and sit down, and they would have silence for half an hour. And then Mershit would begin to speak. And each one of those lectures became a chapter in the book called The Inner Life. And this is, in fact, Mershit's most successful publication to date, because Shambhala picked it up and published it and distributed it properly. So more than 40,000 copies of that have been sold, which is much more than any other book of Mershit's has ever sold. It's his best-known teaching now. And they are extraordinarily beautiful, but also very, very challenging lectures. What he requires you to do is far beyond what most of us are willing to do. Well, at least I'll speak for myself. It's far beyond what I'm willing to do up until this point to begin the inner life, which is you have to clear your past completely. That's the first step. You have to apologize to everyone you've ever harmed or, and you know, I mean, it's like dying, like the Sufi way of dying. You have to, you know, really clear everything away so that you're free. But the interesting thing is that those lectures were then taken immediately by Shabazz Mitchell and Sophia Saintsbury Green to England, transcribed, edited, and published. Lectures were given in September, and by December they had the book, The Inner Life, which really impressed Mershit. The lectures on the problem of the day have never been gathered and published for some reason. I guess people didn't find them so interesting as The Inner Life, something. They're quite interesting lectures, actually. But The Inner Life immediately became a book, and this opened Mershit's mind to a possibility that he hadn't quite considered before. And so it became the pattern of the rest of his summer schools to give series of lectures designed to be made into books. So I think it's a good...
23.
In 23, 24, 25, and 26, there were series given...
The Inner Life.
The Inner Life was 22, September of 22. We have a few little recordings of Mershit speaking on the radio, because radio was new in those days, you know. And he was very excited about the radio, because it seemed, you know, now you could speak and people could hear you all over the place. In fact, when he gave a Christmas message in New York in 1925, they printed it up and they wrote at the top, a radio address given by Piero Mershit in Nayakhan to more than 2 million listeners. And I thought, well, how could they possibly know how many people were listening? And then I realized the 2 million figure was how many people could have listened to it at that point. And obviously they weren't all listening to it. But let's say Mershit was very excited by this technology. He saw it as something that could contribute greatly to the spreading of the message. And of course he would be even more excited by the things that are available to us now.
There's no such thing as a perfect personality. There must have been something, a thorn in Mershit's personality somewhere, I would think.
Yeah.
Can you say what that could be?
Yeah, so Mershit's fault. Well, Mershit himself says your Mershit has 1,000 faults.
What?
And so let me see if I can list them all. I would say, well, he says his biggest fault as a spiritual teacher and guide is that he always tried to make people go faster than they were ready to go. Mm-hmm. Habitually, he tried to push them, and this was a mistake, but he couldn't get over doing this. He wanted them to advance as quickly as possible, and they couldn't. And so he was disappointed in them, but then ultimately disappointed in himself that he was trying to do something that really didn't work. Aside from that, what were his faults? He never slept enough. He habitually slept 3 hours a night, and he went for 10 years sleeping 3 hours a night, and that's not enough sleep. So he must have been sleep deprived, and had his nerves on edge because of that. I mean, I would. I don't know. I sleep 5 hours, and that's barely enough. So I don't know how you could sleep 3 hours every night for year after year. He had. He was a very, as we saw in his youth, he was a very refined person. But there were some areas in which his tastes were not at all refined. Food is one. He had no appreciation for fine food and was perfectly happy to eat. He had a very hearty appetite, and he would eat lots of food, and he'd just eat whatever people put in front of him with no discrimination whatsoever, and thereby gave a bad example to his followers, shall we say. He did have ideas about food, the food for the Sufi. You know, this it's something that Hayat Stadlinger passed on to us. Prescriptions about what you should eat and what you shouldn't eat, which are, I think, pretty much... What do you think, Shams, about food for the Sufi?
I prefer the Gatha on vegetarian.
Okay. but anyway, it's not too bad, is it? I mean, it's, what he suggests is an improvement on what most people eat, shall we say. And, he didn't follow his own advice when it came to eating. He didn't... when Parvalite used to travel around, people he was going to stay with would get a five-page essay about what he could eat and what he couldn't eat, which was completely ridiculous because when he was at home, Mary fed him and she didn't follow any instructions at all. She just made whatever she felt like for him. Anyway, Murshid had no sheet to tell people what to feed him, and he just ate whatever they made with great gusto. He loved eating. What else could you say about him? He was very inattentive to sort of what you might call worldly things. He never, you know, arrangements for travel, all of these things. He didn't pay nearly enough attention to them. He would sometimes arrive someplace without, you know, he'd be on the train and he'd get to someplace and there wouldn't be anybody there to meet him, and he wouldn't even remember who it was that was supposed to meet him or any idea how to contact them. He was just left standing there on the platform. He was inattentive to the details of life, I guess you would say. Yeah, I think he had far fewer flaws than most people, but he was definitely a human being. No one has ever suggested anything other than that, a very remarkable human being, but far from perfect. But this is just my opinion. When I interviewed Shamshir, he assured me that Murshid never once in his life made a false move. And I looked into those brilliant blue eyes and said, well, that's one way to look at it. I mean, to myself, I said this, not to him. but for me, this is not possible. And I'm sure that, Moses, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, Krishna, all of them had their personal shortcomings. And their followers don't choose to remember those things. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Well, I have a question about his family life and his
yes.
relationship with his wife.
Yes.
And did he spend a lot of time with his children? Did he... Where were they when he was off doing these other things?
Well, they were in school. But he spent a lot of time with his children. They have a lot of very fond memories of, you know, riding horsey on his knee and all of these things, or playing music for him. One of Hidayat's most vivid memories is when his father gave him a little tiny violin like this when he was a little boy, and he took this as an indication of what he was supposed to do. He played with them. The children all used to, when they got up in the morning, would come and get in bed with their parents in a big bed, and they snuggled all together there. And when he was there, he was very, very attentive to his family. But increasingly, as time went on, he was there less and less. And his own view of it, and they accepted this view, was that he had this huge commission to carry out, and that of course he couldn't be a normal family father, pater familias, and deliver this message. And so family life had to be sacrificed to this great mission. Yes, he did neglect his family, no doubt about that. Yes.
Could you speak on the development on the Sufi thoughts that originally were southern?
Oh, sure. Yes, I'd be glad to do that. What became eventually the Sufi thoughts originated in seven Sufi teachings. They were originally called Sufi teachings, of which there were seven. They were quite different from what eventually became the ten. And the second Sufi teaching is one that always makes my heart sing because of the kind of person I happen to be. The second Sufi teaching is never to be enslaved by principles. Murshid always said, you must use your principles, you must not be used by them. You have to be in charge, and the principles are your tool, let's say.
The first one's good, too. Tell them the first one.
Do I remember it?
To overcome beliefs and disbeliefs by self-realization.
Right. Mm-hmm. Overcome beliefs and disbeliefs by self-realization. Yes, that's beautiful. This was the original way that it came out. And then somebody got to work on Murshid. I don't know who. Or maybe it came from himself. I don't know. But somebody suggested, well, first of all, you could have 10. Because 10 is kind of, you know, the Ten Commandments, so this it seemed like a good number. Better 7 is, according to numerologists, a mystical number and is misunderstood by the world. Whereas 10 is a much better number for something intended for the world. They also suggested, or Murshid thought himself, that the word teachings was a little too strong. I mean, you have 10 commandments, 10 teachings, and so he rethought the language and called them thoughts. These are just thoughts, so that no one could mistake them for dogmas or something that you have to believe or something of that kind. And then someone else, probably Sophia Saintsbury Green, who had a very fine literary sense, suggested, well, wouldn't it be nice if they were all in the same format? And therefore, the 10 Sufi thoughts is there is one something, and then the rest goes on. Everyone starts with there is one something, and it goes on. The last one about the false ego and annihilation underwent several transformations because some people were made very, very uncomfortable by the word annihilation. It was a word used primarily in translations of Buddhist teachings, and people in the West felt really nervous about being annihilated. It wasn't what they were thinking about on the spiritual path. It sounded really bad to them. Because, of course, in the Western religious traditions, the idea of individualism has greatly infected the religious teaching, so that what people want is to be assured of their individual continued survival forever, which is kind of silly when you think of it. But anyway, it's there very basically. No, people don't want to lose their identity, and so Murshid had to continually explain this and eventually change the language. But anyway, so the 10 Sufi thoughts, and they were quite seriously put forward as a kind of summary of Sufi teaching in the book called The Way of Illumination, which was not actually written by Murshid, but was cobbled together by Dr. Gruner from various things that Murshid had taught. You have an extensive commentary on each one of the 10 Sufi thoughts. And I think at that time, the late teens and early 20s, Murshid was thinking of giving a heritage of this kind of summary of what Sufi teaching was all about. However, for some reason, I'm not sure why, maybe you can help me to understand it, it never really caught on. And I don't know what you were taught in your training about the 10 Sufi thoughts, but they had no role in my own training. Nobody ever said anything about them. I had to find them myself. The one that I truly love and think is perhaps his most radical statement is about the holy book. There's one holy book, the sacred manuscript of nature, the only scripture which can enlighten the reader. By which he didn't mean that the holy books are all not valid, because he considered them as much a part of nature as anything else. But I mean, for followers of just about any scripture-based religion, this is a shocking statement to read. For nature lovers, of course, it's perfectly obvious. You say, oh yeah, that's exactly what I think. Although Murshid says that actually, it's very interesting, I ran across this recently, he said people, some people in the modern world like to go into the wilderness, into nature, in order to meditate, but he said, in actuality, nature is not inspiring. Being in nature alone is an opportunity to become quiet enough to access the inspiration which is already there within your own heart. So I'm not sure what else to say about the 10 Sufi thoughts. But,
I think the late teens, 1919.
Yeah. And I think they're a rather neglected part of our teaching, but maybe they just don't. One thing that's very clear is that we are entirely without dogma or enforced beliefs of any kind, and we're entirely open to whatever it is people happen to believe. Our job is not to get people to drop their beliefs or to adopt any beliefs. So all of this is irrelevant to whatever it is we're doing. I've been very, very impressed with many things that he says about psychology, what he called psychology, which is not what we now call psychology. They tell you one story that I think is one of the most telling in this regard, which is that there was a Murid who came, or there was a young man, I should say, who came to Murshid very, very interested. I'm almost certain that this was Bryn Beorse, or Shamshur, as he was later known, but I'm not absolutely certain, but I'm pretty sure. But Murshid tells about it without naming the person, of course. This young man came to him, very interested in his teachings, and they had these very wonderful conversations, and finally, Inayakan said to this young man, well, wouldn't you like to be initiated? Something he never ever said to anyone. I mean, people had to ask him to be initiated. He would never suggest it to anyone. He wasn't into proselytizing or anything of that kind. So it was a very surprising thing. And the young man said, no, Murshid. I mean, I'm not worthy to be initiated. And what do you mean? And he said, oh, well, I do terrible things. And Murshid said, well, really? Well, what terrible things do you do? And he said, well, you know, I drink, I get drunk, I gamble, probably something sexual, I don't know. But anyway, he listed all these terrible things that he did. And Murshid nodded and said yes. And he said, well, I don't think that would necessarily keep you from being initiated, but could you promise me just one thing? Well, yes, Murshid, what would that be? He said, "What would you promise me not to do these things in my presence?"
Uh-oh.
And he said, well, of course, Murshid, I would never think of doing these things in your presence. And Murshid said, oh, well, then it's quite all right, and initiated him. So then, the next time, he went to do, you know, he was about to step into the bar to have a few drinks, and suddenly he felt the presence.
Yeah.
Of and this happened every time that he went to do these things that he liked to do that he himself thought were wrong. See, that's the clue. It's not that anything is wrong or right. Mercer very clearly says nothing in itself is good or bad. But it's in your attitude. And if you think it's wrong and you do it, then you need some help to get over it. And that's what his presence provided in this case. And so this is a very clear example of a way of working. And it was Murshid's way of working. The fact that you were associated with Murshid, the fact, I would say, that you had the incredible good fortune to connect up with Murshid somehow, means that you have to take much, much more seriously becoming the best person you can possibly be, the most effective person you can possibly be, and the person most attuned to the real purpose of your life that you can possibly be. It's a great responsibility at the same time that it's a tremendous joy. And if it weren't for the joy, the responsibility would be meaningless. It would just be, you know, another bad trip. But because of the joy, it means that the responsibility is something that you can really get behind and take seriously and make it your life's work. That's the way I look at it. So his way of working was to give lectures that were like, flypaper to attract people and catch them. And then once that had happened, to take them as personal beings, including their personal lives, deeply into your heart. Murshid was always interested in every detail of the lives of the people that he guided. There was nothing too small for him to take an interest in. And this is an example of how it's love, really. You have to love the people that you're working with, and this doesn't depend on their being lovable, of course. They can be anything but lovable, but you have to love them anyway. That's the practice of the guide, is to love the pupil and to have her best interests, ultimate best interests, the purpose of her existence always in mind, and to make the pupil aware gradually, more and more aware of why they are here and what it is they are to do. Because nobody is here, according to Murshid, just to hang out or enjoy themselves. Everyone has a specific purpose that they are meant to accomplish in their life on Earth. And their chances of actually moving toward that, because this is the only way to have fulfillment in life, is to understand your purpose and to move toward it and fulfill it. Otherwise, life will be unsatisfactory. The person must become gradually aware of what that is, because, the purpose is like the horizon. The farther you advance, the farther it recedes. I mean, what your idea, your idea right now of your purpose will not be your idea 2 years from now, even if you're going in exactly the right direction. It's something that evolves and changes as you move, and the guides, the teachers' role in this is always to help you to understand the next step. Because the ultimate goal, we tend to think in terms of the ultimate goal, God realization or something of that kind, and because this is something so big and so far removed from our daily consciousness, we feel frustrated because we don't really feel like we're making any progress in that direction. But the thing that Murshid emphasizes very strongly is that you don't have to know that. What you have to know is, what is your next step? Just that little step is all you need to know, and then you have to do that. Then you need to know the next step. And you can't really do that very well yourself, because you're too involved in yourself and your history and all of these things, which is why you need a guide who can help you to move in that direction. But as far as really the what you might call the spreading of the message, of fulfilling this commission to be a worldwide message, he came to do something. This tuning on the inner spheres is something for the whole of humanity and has to do with the evolution of our entire species. And in order to be able to take part in that process and help to fulfill that, because, you know, he's left it to us. He died when he was 44 years old, and that was now 87 years ago. And so, it's left to us to carry on this work or not. You know, if we don't do it, then it won't be done at all, probably. We're the ones. And so we have to think of our own lives in terms of somehow taking this beyond how far it has gone already. So let me go on now to the summer school of 1924, where this idea of writing books by giving lectures reached a kind of fulfillment, because in the course of that summer school, he gave a series of lectures that were then made into books. The Purpose of Life, Cosmic Language, The Mind World, and Health. Those four books were all given as series of lectures in this one summer school. He would give, say, every Friday a lecture on the purpose of life, every Monday a lecture on the mind world, every Wednesday a lecture on cosmic language. And all four of these books are really very extraordinary. I would say, from my point of view, Cosmic Language perhaps the most extraordinary of the four, but all of them are really just a brilliant expositions of a particular aspect of the spiritual life. And what is so remarkable about Cosmic Language is that, Mirshad says repeatedly that for the awakened heart, everything is speaking all the time. There's nothing is dead, nothing is inanimate, nothing is silent. Everything there is, every tree, every leaf, every stone is speaking all the time. And in this book, he details that very extensively, and speaks of exactly the way, what it is that you can hear when you listen to a tree, and so forth. And furthermore, gives you a marvelous picture of the way in which seemingly inanimate objects hold the forms of what happens in their presence. Like, for instance, he would say, in this chair that I'm sitting in, when I leave this, the impression of my being on this chair will remain there, and somebody can come in 20 years and sit in this chair, and if they're able, they can feel that that particular energy there. So that this applies to every object that there is. And he says thus, the Sufi tradition is that the place in which a great teacher, a murshid, a saint, is buried, their darga, as it's called, is a place of pilgrimage to which people go, especially on the anniversary of their death. And this is something we do in Delhi, of course, at Murshid's darga. But he says, in actuality, if they want to have access to that being, they would be much wiser to go to the place where that person lived rather than the place where their body is buried. And in this case, that means Fazl Manzil, his house in Surin, and particularly the Oriental Room, which has always been kept not as living quarters, but as a very special room in that house, which you can go and sit in and meditate. And even though the furniture is not original furniture and all of that, Murshid's atmosphere is extremely strong in that room. And this despite the fact that it has gone through a rich and varied history since then, including the Nazi occupation, the hospital, and then the use that it's had over many years as a place of meditation, and then finally, most recently, the room in which Pir Vilayat died. He was a few months before he died, he asked to be moved into that room, and he spent his last months in that particular room. And if you go in there, it's almost overwhelming, all of the different impressions that there are. But access to the being of Murshid is very easy in that place because he was there so much. That's where he always met with his Maries. They came and had their personal meetings with him in that room. And there's also, however, another room in Suren, not one in which he lived, but one in which he visited every day when he was in Suren, and that is the front room in the little building that is now the archive. It was Sakina Fournay's house, which she bought to be easily available to him right across the street. And he used to come over when he was in Suren every afternoon and sit with Sakina in this room. And he dictated most of his biography there and many other things to her. And we still have in that room the two identical chairs on which the two of them sat. I suppose they didn't always sit on the same chair. I don't know, they're kind of interchangeable. But when you come to visit in Suren, I will take you into that room and have you sit on one of those chairs, and then I'll go out and close the door and leave you to experience what there is there. I remember, and people have had most extraordinary experiences there. I remember once Shahabuddin came to visit, and I put him in the room on the chair and went downstairs. I said, take your time, stay as long as you want. And to my surprise, about 10 minutes later, he appeared downstairs and he said, well, that's all I can take. And I can take a lot, he said.
Wow.
So it's, and in a way, the presence is even more powerful there, not because he spent more time there, but because nobody else has been there. There's no other history to that room. That's all that it's been. And the archive is somehow just a hidden building. People don't even notice that it's there. It's so veiled, shall we say. But if you come within the next 2 years, I will be very happy to sit you in there, and you can see how much you can take.
Shirifu, you mentioned the darshan sessions in the...
Yes, but they weren't in the Oriental room. It wasn't called darshan, we use that word, but it was called the samadhi silence, and it took place in the lecture hall across the street in the garden that was since torn down, and it went like this. It was most extraordinary. It was on Saturday night that people would go to that place. Murshid would meditate all day long on Saturday. He would be in the Oriental room meditating the entire day by himself. And then as it was getting toward sunset, two big men would come and hold him by either arm to walk across the street to the lecture hall, because he was really in samadhi and not really connected very much with the earth in this state. So they just held him and walked him across there. And then in the lecture hall itself, at the back left-hand corner, there was a curtain that was put up. And Murshid sat in a chair behind the curtain, continuing his meditation. The Marids were selected on the basis of application to go to a particular session. So those who had been designated for a particular session, he could see about 25 people in an evening this way, would go to the hall and sit there in silence. And then the doors, of course, would be would be locked and nobody was to be anywhere around there. And when the time came for you to have your session, either Fazal Mai or Murshida Green, they alternated this job, would come to your seat and get you and take you by the hand and lead you around behind the curtain and sit you in a chair in front of Murshid. The Marids were instructed when they sat there to keep their eyes open. Murshid was sitting there with his eyes closed, but they were instructed to keep their eyes open and not to close their eyes. And then as they sat there, at some point, Murshid would slowly open his eyes and would look directly into their eyes for a moment. Then he would close his eyes again, and that meant it was time to go. They would be led out and would go out a different door in the back of the hall. And as I said, he would the sessions tended to last a few minutes. I mean, there was no way to schedule it. It was just whenever the moment came for Murshid to open his eyes, and you can see the eyes. I mean, I think in a way this photograph captures something of what they saw when he gave them this extraordinary. I don't even know what to call it. Darshan is a traditional Indian word for it, but this zap that they had. And uniformly, all of the people that I met who had known Murshid, who had been at the summer school, every single one of them described this experience of the Samadhi silence as the most important experience in their spiritual training. Mm-hmm. So whatever it was that he conveyed in that glance was something that stayed with them through their... usually these people were in their 80s by the time I saw them. But it was like when I would ask them about it and they would describe it, it was as though it was happening that very moment. I mean, it was a timeless moment for every single one of them. And there's a book that's coming out quite soon, a book by a man named Theo van Hoorn that was written a long time ago, but it has only been in Dutch up until now. Now an English translation has been made, and it's being published as part of the Jubilee publications. And this book will be out before the end of this year. And there, Theo van Hoorn gives by far the most extensive description of this whole process that has ever been published anywhere, and it's really quite marvelous. The questions and answers are quite interesting because the way in which the questions were done by Murshid is he asked people to write down their questions on a piece of paper and then hand them in, and then he would have a pile of questions and he would just pick them up and answer them. So presumably even he didn't know who had asked the question, although he seemed really to know. And but it's a funny thing, I can tell you, because now I know too. In most instances, I just read the question. I know who asked that question because I know the people who were in the audience, and I know the things they were interested in. Some of them were not very pleasing to Murshid. People were constantly asking him about reincarnation because Theosophy had introduced that idea very strongly into Europe, and people found it utterly fascinating because, of course, it's something they didn't know of from their own religious tradition. And Murshid was really, really not interested in reincarnation. And he said, in fact, the Hindu teachers that he attended upon in his tour around India were also not interested in reincarnation. It was not a subject. It was something that fascinated Europeans for some reason, and they kept asking about it. And he didn't actually believe in reincarnation in the sense that we usually understand it. That is, he didn't believe that a soul incarnated as one person and then later incarnated as another person and another person. Not at all. The soul, he says, makes one single journey from the source to here, this is the end. You'll be happy to hear. You don't have to go any farther than this. No place else to go from here but back again. This is the ultimate goal, is life on Earth, which is also the most difficult circumstance that you will ever encounter. Because, well, let's say it's this way. In the mind world, which is the next plane above this one, that plane is where your mind is. Your mind isn't here. Your mind is there, so to speak. And your body is here. And the difference is this. In the mind world, thought is the only reality. So if you think of something, that thing exists as fully as it possibly can. On the earth, on the other hand, on this plane, there are all of these difficulties. You think of something, and then to make it into something real requires a really difficult process, discipline, concentration, perseverance, all of these qualities, and that's what you have the opportunity to develop here on the earth, is to learn how to make a thought into something concrete and real in that sense. You know, not real in the ultimate sense, but real in terms of the material world, and that's a difficult thing, and it requires mastery. It's a mastery through accomplishment, basically, that this plane teaches us. That, of course, can be very, very frustrating. Usually is. Usually you can't actually fulfill your thought on Earth. It's rare for that actually to happen. Murshid's idea was this. The Earth plane is unique in that beings create accommodations for other beings by reproduction. We make another body, and then another soul from the mind world can incarnate in that body. So, 1925, November 25th, 1925, at Cherbourg in France. It's do you know French geography at all? There's a kind of peninsula in off of Normandy that goes up, and Cherbourg is at the very end of that. It's the place in France that's closest to Ireland, for example. And it was a port at which passenger ships stopped. The ship that he went on was called the Volendam, which is a very charming little city in Holland. It was a new ship, that is to say, this was in 1925. The ship was commissioned in 1924, and it was practically a brand new ship. He and Kismet Stam together got on the ship and sailed to New York. While they were on shipboard, a number of things happened. One was that he and Kismet wrote up a number of newspaper articles, or what they thought of as newspaper-like articles, to be sent out to newspapers for publicity in the United States. I don't know, but I don't think any of them ever got published. But they're very nice. They begin the book that I have edited now and will be coming out soon. But also, several of the passengers on board got interested in this figure, chatting with Murshid, and they asked him to give a lecture. So he gave a long lecture with lots of questions and answers on board the ship. That's the only time that ever. Once he got to New York, there was a wealthy Marid named Mr. Chase Crowley in New York, who booked him and Kismet into the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, which at the time was the leading hotel in New York and one of the most famous hotels in the world. That's where they stayed during their whole stay in New York. And it's also where he gave his first series of lectures. There was some kind of a lecture hall within the hotel where he gave a series of lectures which were very, very well attended and reported in the newspapers extensively and drew a lot of attention to his presence there. And as they went out into January, he started giving universal worship services every Sunday. And the second one of those on the 10th of January, I think I mentioned to you yesterday, such a large crowd of people came that they had to change to a larger hall. More than 500, more like 1,000 people were actually there at this universal worship. And Merchant was thrilled, and he was sure this was the first sign that everything was taking off in the way that he'd been waiting for it to happen for a long time. And he stayed there in New York for the rest of the month of January, giving a number of lectures, although in some cases, later in the month, the audience for the lectures was disappointing. It didn't remain at as high a level as he wished, and various people tried to come up with different explanations for why this was, but it's not apparent. The lectures themselves are all excellent. And I would say this collection of lectures from the American tour in 1926 are the most remarkable lectures Bishop gave. One after another are really splendid. So this book I think you will enjoy very, very much once it comes out. Right at the beginning of February, he proceeded from New York to Detroit, was his first stop, and he had a large number of Marites there, and many of them were socially prominent people. He was so highly regarded that somehow Henry Ford, who was kind of the king of Detroit, heard that he was coming and took a great interest in his coming there. And although he didn't have time himself to go to the lectures, he said, which I suppose is credible enough, he sent a stenographer to take them all down word for word and give a transcript of the lectures to Henry Ford. And then when the lecture series was finished, the lectures all took place at something called the 20th Century Club, which was an extremely snooty but highly progressive club, women's club in Detroit. And when the lecture series was finished, Henry Ford requested a personal interview with Merchant, who went to his office. Henry Ford came in, and they had a long conversation there. There was a reporter present who wrote it all down, and it was published in the newspaper on the front page the next day with the headline, Mystic Meets Magnate. And it's a really very, very interesting conversation. Now, if we had lots of time, I would read you the whole article, but it's rather long. It will be in the book. It's embodied in the preface to the book, and you'll be able to read the whole thing. But it's a real conversation that they have. It isn't one-sided. It isn't Merchant lecturing Henry Ford or vice versa. They have a real exchange, and it also uncovers something rather interesting that, Henry Ford, who was at the very acme of American industry, and in fact, probably more than any other single individual responsible for the world we live in, having created the assembly line, having insisted that his workers be paid enough to be able to buy the cars that they were making, which entailed increasing daily wages by 5 times over what they had been before that. He was really a revolutionary figure in world history and has had a tremendous impact. But the interview also reveals that he really did have a spiritual side and understood these things in a rather profound way. So it's a beautiful piece of reporting, and for once I think Merchant couldn't possibly complain about the way the newspaper represented him, because it has his own words there in abundance. Curiously enough, at one point in the article, the reporter refers to Merchant as the elderly prophet. And the funny thing about it is that Merchant was 20 years younger than Henry Ford at the time of the interview. but seemed to be much older than Henry IV. Well, from there he went to Chicago, but not to give any lectures. Nothing had been arranged, but in order to, he did give some interviews and also began to make the arrangements for lectures when he returned later on. And from there they went, they got the train directly from Chicago to San Francisco, one of the great train journeys of the world, except that for people from Europe, for example, who are used to going everywhere on the train, it's an unbelievably long journey across lots of nothing at all, because there's nothing like the Great Plains anywhere in Europe. And until you get to the mountains, it's pretty much just flat everywhere around you. There's a very charming story that Kismet tells, that they were somewhere in Wyoming, of all places, and the train stopped. In those days, there weren't dining cars on the train. When it was time to eat, the train stopped and you went to a cafe and had your meal and then got back. Everybody got back on the train. When it was time to sleep, the train stopped. Everyone went to a hotel for the night. Then they came back and proceeded on. There were Pullman cars. They existed before this, but on this train there weren't any Pullman cars. So they, it was just a stop-and-go kind of operation. But so they stopped in this little town in Wyoming and they all went to eat. But Mershit, of course, as I told you, did everything very slowly, including eating. He did very slowly. And so everybody else got their food and was finished and went back to the train, and Mershit was still just beginning his meal and eating very slowly. And Kismet, who was a lot more practical person than Mershit, started to get very nervous about the train leaving and tried to urge him. And whenever people urged Mershit to hurry up, he would laugh and laugh. He would say, "Oh, Kismet is always in a hurry. You know, but this, no, don't worry, it's perfectly all right." And so leisurely, he finished his meal, and they started walking back. And Mershit insisted on walking at his very slow pace, not hurrying in any way. And then off in the distance, as they were approaching, they saw the train pull out of the station. And it went about 100 yards and then suddenly stopped. And then Mershit and Kismet just proceeded, got on the train, and then it went again. So now what actually happened? I mean, we could say this is a miracle story. Mershit, by the power of his thought, stopped the locomotive or something of that. I think what much more likely happened is that somebody was looking out the window and saw them walking there, and they said, "Oh, you know, that funny man isn't here yet," and the conductor stopped the train. But who knows what really happened? It makes a good story. Anyway. And they went on to San Francisco, where Rabia Martin's already thriving center had grown much larger in the wake of his 1923 visit. And there were a number of Marids that he knew very well from the previous visit. Samuel Lewis, for example, he met and interacted with a number of times in 1923 and was most anxiously awaited in 1926. And a number of other people. And he stayed there for a month in San Francisco, giving classes to the Marids and also giving public lectures. And then he wanted to make a trip to Southern California. And so Paul Reps, whose Sufi name was Saladin, was one of the Marids in the center. He wasn't yet involved in Zen Buddhism. And he volunteered to drive them to Southern California. Rabia Martin went with them, so there you had a car with Mershit, Kismet Stam, Rabia Martin, and Paul Reps. It must have been an interesting journey. They didn't make a fast journey. They went along the coast so that Mershit could see the magnificent coastline of California. And their first stop was in Santa Barbara, where Mershit had a khalif, a man named Conaton, an Irishman, actually, who had moved and was living there then. And a man, well, his picture in the biography And I don't know what your take on him is, aside from the fact that he has very big ears. Looking at him, I would not immediately think he was very promising material. But Merchant saw something extraordinary in him and was very fond of him and was determined to go to Santa Barbara, where he gave a number of lectures and stayed with his Khalif, Konatin, and always spoke very, very highly of this man. Who'd had a rich and interesting history, which I won't go into now. But then they proceeded from Santa Barbara on to Los Angeles, where they came into contact with a couple named Wolf, Mr. and Mrs. Franklin Wolf, who are the predecessors of the Fraternity of Light, still existing organization that we've recently gotten back into contact with after a long time of separation. And there in Los Angeles, where there were no Marids to speak of, the Wolfs arranged a number of lectures for him, and he gave, it's really very strange, but he gave some of the most powerful lectures that he ever gave there in Southern California, where he knew nobody and had no background, nothing of the kind. And particularly then, they went on from Los Angeles first to La Jolla, which is a very upscale northern suburb of San Diego, where he spoke at some place called the Casa de Mañana, the house of tomorrow. But mañana in Spanish also is, you know, implies, what's the word, someday, right? It doesn't just mean tomorrow, it means, oh, mañana, you know, we'll do it mañana. And what I have no idea what the Casa de Mañana was, but he gave that astounding lecture called Sufism, the Religion of the Heart, there, which you've read undoubtedly some versions of that great lecture, which is almost the defining lecture of what Sufism is for Mershon. And then proceeded to San Diego, where he gave another lecture, then back to Los Angeles, where he gave several more lectures, one of them in something called the Church of Truth, which I think was a kind of new thought center of some kind. All of them really wonderful lectures. Then back again to San Francisco, where he stayed for another 2.5 weeks through Easter. And then he proceeded on the return journey. But he had conceived some desire to go to the Grand Canyon. And so on the return journey, they went there. You went by train in those days to the Grand Canyon and stayed there at the splendid El Tovar Hotel, which is still there, just wonderful. Fred Harvey made these hotels along the railroad, just marvelous places. I had his picture taken on a horse, and actually one of those he sent as a postcard back to Surin, and became a very precious possession of the children there, who of course, from that point on, conceived a great desire to go to the Grand Canyon. And it even extended to the point where Perbalayat was mad to do a retreat in the Grand Canyon. But when he talked to me about this, I said, well, I don't think you can. I mean, that's... but it so happened, just by sheer coincidence, of course, that the next semester I had a student in one of my classes who worked as a park ranger at the Grand Canyon during the summer. And I asked him about this, and he said, oh yeah, I know about a really nice cave that hardly anybody knows about, and I can tell you how to get there. And I said, well, you know, wouldn't we have to get permission and all these things? He said, oh no, just don't tell anybody. Nobody will know. So I told Perbalayat about this, and indeed, we converged there on the Grand Canyon. My friend Fazl, he was called Shanaz at that time. Now he's gone back to being Fazl again. Came with Perbalayat, and we all hiked down to this great plateau halfway down the Grand Canyon and found this cave and spent the night there. But ultimately, happily, Perbalayat decided not to do a retreat there. I say happily because, well, you know, when Pirbalite wanted to be alone in the wilderness, it took a support staff of about 15 people so that he could be alone there in the wilderness.